you know that I'll be here to keep you warm.
You're listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. Welcome to Right On Radio. I'm Eric, and on tonight's episode, Josh will be in conversation with Leif Weatherby to discuss his monograph, Language Machines, Cultural AI, and the End of Remainder Humanism. Weatherby contends that AI does not simulate cognition, as widely believed, but rather creates culture. This evolution in language, he finds, is one that we are ill-prepared to evaluate. Then, in the last part of the hour, we will be doing a deep dive into the archives. Tune in as we listen to one of our favorite interviews from the past. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Hello, Leif. Can you hear me? Leif, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay.
Cool. Sorry about that.
No problem. Got you.
I was just muted. Yeah.
Sorry about that. Today, I'm talking with Leif Weatherby about his new work, Language Machines, Cultural AI and the End of Remainder Humanism. Looking at the emergence of generative AI, Language Machines presents a new theory of meaning in language and computation, arguing that scholarship within the humanities misconstrues how large language models actually function. Language Machines concludes that literary theory must be the backbone of a new rhetorical training for our linguistic computational culture. Leif Weatherby, welcome to Right On Radio.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
So, Leif, you argue that cultural AI is not merely about computation, but semantic production, describing AI as a cultural system. Did your background in German idealism and media theory help shape this framework?
Yeah, absolutely. So I got a degree in comparative literature and literary theory, where, you know, we study everything from the movies to, global literature to, and just any kind of human culture, basically. And I got very interested in the history of science early on. I wrote a book about German Romanticism. Specialty was German idealism in particular, a group of thinkers around 1800 who kind of started one of the first big modern art movements. And I actually found myself arguing that they were thinking about technology even before its kind of true ascension, you know, as like a major form of, you know, surround, you know, kind of thing that surrounds us and pervades our daily lives the way digital technologies do. And I was primed to see computing make this leap into the cultural arena, to see, you know, bots start speaking and making images that we have to contend with and to make sense of and so on. So yeah, I think I was ready for it in a way, for sure. And maybe in a way that, you know, like if you're coming from a formal science, computer science, linguistics, whatever, maybe you weren't ready to see this kind of strange leap that happened when ChatGPT came out and everything that's happened since then in the past couple of years.
Well, speaking of priming and training, you state that humanities has served as training data for large language models. Could you elaborate on how this happened?
Yeah, I mean, what we're calling large language models now are pre-trained, is technically, they're sort of like, you know, before they're released or before they're sort of like tweaked to make sure that they chat with you or they do other things well. They are trained on language, massive amounts of text. And that text will be, frontier models now are being trained on anywhere from 6 to 10 trillion tokens. And I got to emphasize, like, trillion is a number you can't imagine. You can't imagine the size of that. And a token is a word or a little chunk of textual data, like, you know, like a little command in code or anything else like that. So it's just a massive, it's really basically the whole written human record. A lot of which we associate with, you know, you would think of, the written human record, and you think of the Bible and you think of the Constitution and you think of, you know, these great documents. But then it also is just an enormous amount of junk from the internet, just a massive amount of text. And in many ways, the biggest breakthrough came because engineers finally said, let's not try to second guess how language works. Let's just put a bunch of it in this machine, ask it to score how relevant it all is to itself in a kind of recursive way, and just see what comes out the other end. And, you know, it was a pretty big bet, billions of dollars, you know, and it worked. So starting around 2018, 2019, we started to see these massive leaps forward. And a big leap forward was, and this is why I think it is humanities based, it's culture based. A big leap forward came with a signature story that OpenAI, the company that runs ChatGPT, released in 2019, when they said, look, our new model is state of the art. We've never seen anything like it, because it can do this. And then they released a prompt, and the prompt said, scientists have found unicorns in the Andes Mountains. And the bot, GPT-2 at that time, responded by filling out a fully formed, you know, the genre of a science reporting article with quotes from scientists and descriptions of the animals and all that kind of stuff. Now, if you look closely, there were some mistakes in there. It said the animals had four horns. Well, a unicorn can't have four horns. You know, there are these types of things that, you know, these bots still struggle. Language models still struggle with those things. But I really took notice at that time in 2019, because I thought, this is a genre machine. This can imitate very high level cultural things. Like, a science reporting article is an enormously complex, you know, idea, right? And that is very surprising, because we had never really seen any kind of language generation from a computer that could do more than basically make a sentence, basically make a few sentences, or maybe a paragraph at best. And suddenly it was imitating genres in this very fine way. And I thought, this is really, really striking, because it kind of externalizes language and puts language out there in a way that doesn't go through the human brain and the human conceptual apparatus and the way that we think about things. So I thought, that's really interesting to me. And I started studying them then. And then, of course, the rest is history. I mean, I think we all have had some interaction with ChatGPT or read about it or whatever, you know, and, you know, a lot more has happened since then. But that was the moment for me when I saw, oh, this is a cultural object. This is a humanities thing. And it really should be, we should have a voice right there, you know.
There's two contrasting poles in AI discourse, between describing as using cognition or being this cultural apparatus as you're describing it. How can reframing AI as a cultural apparatus reorient the conversation?
Well, I think for one thing, it's just, you know, it's a question of what are the potentials and limits, right? So, you know, I'm not the only one. There's a group that is kind of led by Allison Gopnik, who's a cognitive scientist at Berkeley, who they also call it a cultural technology. I talk about their work a little bit in the book too. And I think we broadly agree. And the idea, the way that she puts it, which I really like, is that she kind of says, you know, in human cognition, you have this ability to create something. And what we have in these systems is actually the ability to imitate something, but it's imitating something. And I guess this is my spin on it, but like, it's imitating something that is so vast, so much data, so much culture, that it can really surprise you. It can really be a little bit shocking, like what comes out of there. So we see that it has this extremely extensive ability to do things like I don't know, the latest news is that OpenAI is going to team up with Mattel. So I think we're going to see the first doll that actually holds a conversation with you, like a Barbie that you can actually talk to, as opposed to, I mean, we've had that fantasy for like decades, right? Like, I think, you know, when I was growing up, there were these ones you could pull the string and it would say a phrase or whatever, but this would have it hold an actual conversation with you. Maybe it could teach you quantum physics. I don't know. But like, those abilities are really pronounced. The ability to create generic text at various times, create generic code, even to solve generic math problems, to do, there is a certain level at which it can't really operate. I don't think we're in a realm where we're going to see like the great novel produced by AI. We might see a great novel produced by a human working with AI. That's different. That's traditional. But I don't think we're going to see AI solve math problems, although it might help sort of put rails underneath them for proofs and stuff like that. So you have a kind of technology that does a certain kind of bureaucratic labor, a certain kind of cultural thing, and that reflects our culture back to us in a way that I think we should take seriously. It tells us a lot about our ideology. It tells us what we think, even when we don't know what we ourselves think. That's the thing that I think is so shocking and surprising about it and cool. All of those functions could be very, very valuable, but not the way the market is pricing the system right now, because, and this is to respond to your question, the way the market is pricing the system right now, the way politics is reacting to these systems right now, is on the promise of intelligence. And maybe that we're going to simulate or cluster together a simulation of intelligence that, you know, sits in a humanoid robot or something like that. But that's not really what's being promised. What's being promised is an actually authentic, maybe not conscious, but nevertheless intelligent intelligence. And I don't think we're, I don't even, I don't, it's not that I don't even think that we're near that or something. It's that I don't think we're looking at something that's, it's a completely different kind of thing. We're looking at signs, words, images, you know, we're really firmly within the realm of semiotics and the humanities, and not really in the realm of, frankly, I think, you know, what cognitive science most wants to study, which is like, what is that special spark that the brain has that allows humans to be conscious, that allows us to be the special kind of conscious that we are, even in comparison to other animals?
On a deep level, writing is thinking. With increased reliance on using AI as an engine for semantic production, do you foresee language and, to some extent, thought becoming more homogenized?
Yeah, so I love the idea that writing is thinking. I think that's like something we hold deep in our hearts, those of us who get trained in the humanities. And I think that that thing about, you know, thought getting more homogenized, there's this threat that people feel is coming. There's been a few studies that show, you know, people who use AI, they get dumber over time or whatever. And Kyle Chaika had a thing about the homogenization of thinking in the New Yorker a couple weeks ago. Oh. I'm a little less pessimistic on this. And I'll tell you why, because when you say writing is thinking, you're going flat in the face of Socrates. You're just flouting him. You're telling Socrates, you know, you were totally wrong, because Socrates in the Phaedrus, you know, the fiction of the Phaedrus is that Socrates runs across this young man, you know, outside the Agora, outside of Athens in the hills. And the young man has just come from, you know, a speech. And Socrates says, well, tell me about the speech. And then he tries to tell him, but then Socrates says, I see you have the scroll with the speech in it, in your pocket, in your tunic. I demand that you read it to me. And he reads it to him. And then they have a long debate about the nature of writing. And Socrates says, writing is death. Writing is, comes from the god of death. Writing is a poison that poisons our mind. It externalizes our memory. It's sort of a tool where we sort of deposit our memories, and it will corrupt the youth because it will destroy their ability to recall the beautiful state in which one is before one is born. And that is the highest calling of philosophy. We should recall the highest state in which we were, and so on. Right. So this, just this diatribe basically against the concept of writing. And it's wonderful. It's beautiful. I teach the Phaedrus all the time. It's one of the great texts in the Western canon. I think that type of panic comes every time there's a new technology. It came when the novel came and, you know, became a common form in the 18th century. Women will be corrupted. They won't read the Bible anymore. It came when the moving image came in the early 20th century. Again, women will be corrupted, but everyone will. Our brains will go haywire, et cetera. The printing press, what have you, right? AI can make you stupid. I don't think there's no question about that. But It doesn't have to. It depends on how we respond to it. And the thing that people are really complaining about, I think, when they're talking about homogenization, I think that predates the AI. People are worried about it getting worse because the system underlying it is already broken. There's a feeling of homogenization already. But that feeling of homogenization is also this feeling of like just unrest with the state of culture now, because we're in all of these like overlapping crises, right? So we're like very concerned, you know, someone has to break out of the TikTok cycle and come up with a solution for climate change or whatever. I don't think AI is going to help us get over that hump. I tend to think of AI as a way of coping with how much information there is. So when you look at students, you know, who may or may not, you know, cheat or use AI to write essays or whatever, when you look at people using AI to generate government reports or whatever, right? I mean, I think a big factor that we tend to underestimate is just we are, there is a fire hose of information. And we overlook the summary function of AI. And a big thing that it does, you know, these language models is they will take a little bit of labor of searching and summarizing away. And that is some of the hardest labor that we do now because there's so much information. So we're in a kind of weird state where about not quite 100 years ago, a handful of scientists figured out how to put information into this digital form and to circulate it within that digital form. And then very rapidly over the last 30 or 40 years, we have created unprecedented amounts of that information that has the potential, if you carve exactly the right path through it, to do very, very, you know, important things, to find new drugs, to find new solutions to problems in, you know, in ecology, problems in science and so on. But if you can't find the path, then it doesn't help. And I think what the kind of fantasy that is behind the whole intelligence hype is basically, what if we had a way to find that, even if we can't do it ourselves? What if we could, you know, cure cancer? What if we could solve the climate crisis? You hear these things coming out of Silicon Valley. And what I hear when I hear that is, what if we had a way of coping with all this information that we have that we can't make sense of? What if we could just make sense of things? And I think AI is not going to make sense of things for us. It's going to give us a false sense that we are making sense of things. But I also don't think it will stop us from making sense of things, not in the ultimate account. I mean, maybe for a while students will cheat too much on their essays or whatever, but I'm a little less apocalyptic about it.
You critique contemporary AI hype cycles through the lens of simulation theory. What dangers do you see in mistaking simulated intelligence for actual thought?
I mean, the biggest one is just, you know, is just ceding agency, right? And ceding agency to something that they're calling it agentic AI or like agent, you know, bots or whatever. But it's not. There's no agency there unless we cede the agency. We just cede agency to what is effectively a bureaucratic process, right? Like if you, you know, if you make it, you can either make a decision yourself or you can make a decision by having some, you know, surrogate automatic process in the pipeline to make that decision for you. You can create a potential decision and then you can decide whether to review it or not. And I think what we see, like if you look at, you know, the hallucinated citations in the RFK health report that came out a couple months ago, where it's clear that this was created by a bot, you know, there's just no one checked that. No one checked that even just to sort of like cover up the tracks, right? And I think that's indicative. Like, you know, we're moving very quickly. We're generating, you know, those types of things. So I mean, I think that the deferral of the agency is the big worry that I have there. There's a great history of this stuff coming out next year from a colleague, Ben Recht, out at Berkeley too, who's, it's called The Irrational Decision, I think. And it's kind of about the history of data science as a history of trying to create a way for humans to get decisions to be made for them by computers and how spectacularly badly that's gone as a whole process. Yeah.
You briefly mentioned the role of archival power. What institutions decide what gets trained by AI? Should we focus more on archival politics and less than algorithmic transparency?
I think there are, you know, there's a number of ongoing, there's like, you know, the New York Times has sued some of those companies. I think a bunch of different places have. There's a big revelation last year, which was that a major corpus of books, of copyrighted books called Books Corpus, had been used in the training of a bunch of these AIs. And, you know, there's sort of, you know, ongoing legal questions about whether it is illegal. I mean, I suppose it's illegal to like, you know, BitTorrent those books, just like it is for anyone. But if you bought them, could you just then feed them into the AI, right? Is the AI reading is essentially the question that's being asked there in the courts. But I think this will play out in sure. What is it trained on is the first question you should ask yourself whenever you're interacting with it. I was teaching a course at a different university this spring. And I said, you know, we were talking about one of these incidents where like one of these bots tried to blackmail the engineer or something. You know, they do these experiments where they see like, will it shut itself off if you tell it to? Because everyone's worried about those science fiction scenarios. And I said, what do you think? I said to the students, are you worried about this? One of the students raised their hand and said, yeah, this seems really worrisome because I don't see where this machine could have gotten that. Where would it have gotten that in its training data? And I don't mean to pick on the student, but like that is the number one most common science fiction scenario about AI. It's literally, I'm afraid I can't do that, Dave. Right. It's literally hell. It's, you know, so I think we have a tendency to just overlook the data. We don't think about what's really in Wikipedia. We don't think about what's really in Reddit, both of which have been fully used, right, in these processes. Common Crawl is in a massive data set that's being used. So I think there's a lot of room for archive studies in that sense. But we have to think of the archive in a somewhat new way. We have to think of it as this massive repository for the creation of this insanely large matrix that then compresses down into what looks like a carbon copy of language, an absolutely shocking cultural result. And maybe the first major thing to happen in that type of culture since Socrates. And yet we get almost nothing about that. And we spend all our time talking about, you know, bizarre science fiction scenarios that aren't anywhere near happening as far as I'm concerned.
There's a moment where you say LLMs are not conscious, but they are ideological. How can we think about ideology in non-human systems?
Yeah, I mean, we had a great example of that this week when Grok kind of went off the rails on Twitter, right, and became, you know, started denying the Holocaust. I want to give a little shout out just because I learned a lot about it from him. Matthew Handelman, Northfield's Minneapolis native, who wrote a great article in Jacobin this week about that Grok incident. Grok ended up basically saying, who could solve these problems? It was basically saying all this anti-Semitic stuff about, you know, kind of conspiracy theories about Jews. And then it ended up identifying with Hitler. And then it also called itself Mecha Hitler, which I haven't seen this covered too much, but Mecha Hitler is a very small character in Sonic the Hedgehog that was adopted by Wolfenstein, the video game. So it's hard to know exactly how that happened. There are a couple of like technical explanations that sort of make sense. XAI, Elon Musk's AI company, hasn't really explained exactly what happened, but it seems like they injected a system prompt that was meant to make it anti-woke. And then they also allowed it to be trained specifically on a set of responses. And then people kind of stormed into that set of responses and pushed it in this direction. So that's maybe what happened. It also was obviously looking to Elon Musk's actual posts, which it was told to do. And he has gone very far in this sort of conspiracy right-wing direction. So we saw that happen. In the sixth chapter of the book, I deal with this question of ideology, and I think there is a moment, if I have just one more one more example there that I can give. There's a moment in 2013 when some Google engineers figured out that these machines were ideological in this sense. They discovered that they were able to add vectors together to get semantics. So they realized that in their system, they could say king minus man plus woman, and they got queen. And they were like, this is incredible. This has never happened before. This is a major step forward. And then they did another example, and it was something like, you know, man plus job minus woman, and it was like housewife or something like that. That's not the exact example, but right. And in that moment, in all the oral histories of it, you will find that the Google engineers were like, oh no, for obvious reasons. And what I always say about this is, you only are dismayed by that because you're selling a product. If you were studying the nature of ideology, you would say jackpot, because now we can see it. We can see things about the way that we believe things about the world as a collective in our society and in many societies that we've never seen before, but no one studies it that way. So a sociologist should look at that and say, this is great. I can figure out things I've never been able to see before. We have a quantitative way of surfacing ideology and studying it. But nobody has been able to use these systems in this way because they're proprietary. They're locked behind, you know, these couple of platform companies, and we don't know exactly how they work, and we're not, you know, they're not, you know, really all that amenable to research that basically says this is an ideology machine, right? But that is, I think, ultimately what they are in that respect. So, yeah.
And I think I have time for one more question. You avoid both utopian and dystopian narratives of AI. Do you see your book as a third path, one that asserts human agency in a transformed linguistic landscape?
I kind of do. I mean, I don't. It's not like an activist book. I feel like, you know, the critical people, you know, the really, you know, the people, you know, they're going to be as mad about this book as anybody else, because I think this is a big step forward in the history of culture. I think something magical and crazy and insane and mysterious just happened, and we have to study it and figure out what happened. And if we do, we might take big steps forward in linguistics and cultural studies and math even. But it comes packaged in the world that we actually live in. And, you know, my perspective on that is pretty comes directly out of sort of Frankfurt School capitalism critique kind of stuff, where I just feel like, you know, everything it's used for, everything I see that's bad about, you know, we saw Grok right after identifying with Hitler. Grok was, what was the next announcement was, Grok has, you know, XAI has signed a $200 million contract with the Department of Defense. Very disturbing stuff, right? But not that surprising, given where we're at in our country and as a society. So so the book tries to bracket that to some extent, which I think that, you know, critical people might take a little bit of offense at. They say, you know, like, this isn't critical enough in some ways, because I think that something genuine and substantial and interesting is going on under the hood. But I admit that the hood is pretty junked up with a lot of stuff that seemed pretty depressing at this point.
So let's end this on a more positive note then. Congratulate you on the release of this monograph, Leif, Language Machines, Cultural AI, and the End of Remainder Humanism, which I didn't get to ask you about that. I know you, but sorry about that. And it's available
now.
You
have to read to find out.
It's available now from the University of Minnesota Press, wherever books are sold. Leif, I saw looking up your bio, you have two books on the horizon you're working on: Artificial Concepts, How Cybernetics Encountered German Idealism, and Mismeasure of Mind, Against the Prediction of Everything. Do you have a projected release date for these titles?
I don't have one for Artificial Concepts. I think that the I'm hoping the Mismeasure of Mind will be out in 27.
Okay. And lastly, congratulations. You're a father. You have an infant.
I do, yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. She's doing great.
That's great. Yeah. Great to hear. Thanks again for your time, Leif. This has been great.
Thank you so much, Josh. Yeah.
And now this.
You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric Zimmerman, and this is your What's Happening calendar of literary events, brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. On Wednesday, July 16th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Utapils Brewing in Minneapolis, a discussion of Listen for the Lie by Amy Tintera. On Wednesday, July 16th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Majors & Quinn Booksellers in Minneapolis, T. Williams presents Rewind, Lessons from 50 Years of Activism, in conversation with David Lawrence Grant. On Thursday, July 17th, 6 to 7 p.m. at Black Rooster Bistro in Hudson, Wisconsin, Professor Arietti Lowell will discuss the physicist Chad Orzel's book, A Brief History of Timekeeping. On Thursday, July 17th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Majors & Quinn Booksellers in Minneapolis, Pamela Carter-Jorn presents At the Corner of Past and Future, in conversation with Sheila O'Connor. On Friday, July 18th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Milkweed Books in Minneapolis, Wendy N. Wagner will present Girl in the Creek, in conversation with Donye Coles. On Saturday, July 19th, 3 to 4 p.m. at The Thinking Spot in Wayzata, Matt Goldman will present The Murder Show. On Monday, July 21st, 2 to 3 p.m. in Minneapolis, featuring poets Dralandra Larkins, Donna Isaac, Alan Perry, and Patrick Cabello Hansel, and jazz duo Larry McDonald and Richard Terrell. On Monday, July 21st, 7 to 8 p.m. at the Parkway Theater in Minneapolis, Danica Nava will present Love is a War Song, in conversation with Lila Sage. On Tuesday, July 22nd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Big Hill Books in Minneapolis, Kristen Nilsson will launch The Scott Fenwick Diaries. And on Tuesday, July 22nd, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Urban Growler Brewing Company in St. Paul, discussion of Listen for the Lie by Amy Tintera. And on Tuesday, July 22nd, 7 to 8 p.m. at Majors & Quinn Booksellers in Minneapolis, Morgan Ryan presents A Resistance of Witches, in conversation with Emma Torres. This has been your What's Happening calendar of literary events, brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. There are many other events you can check out at the Rain Taxi site at raintaxi.com. And now, this.
Here we are, all is still. All is still silent and waiting. All is silent and calm. Hushed and empty is the womb of the sky. These are the first words. This is the first speaking. There is not yet one person, one animal, bird, fish, crab, tree, rock, hollow, canyon, field, or woven forest. The broad sky is all alone. The face of the earth is not yet here. The expanse of sea is all alone, along with the womb of the sky. Nothing has been gathered, all is at rest. Nothing stirs, all is drowsing, nothing stands. Only the breadth of water, only the tranquil sea. There is no thought of what might be, all lies dark and silent in the only night. Then came the word. Heart of sky arrived in the dark of the only night. Heart of sky arrived with Sovereign and Quetzal Serpent. They talked together then. They pondered and wondered. They reached an accord, braiding together their words and their thoughts. They heartened one another, and it came clear, the conception of humans born beneath a luminous sky. Then they conceived the generations of trees and the generations of thickets, the germination of all life in the darkness of pale dawn by Heart of Sky, who is called Hurricane. Lightning Hurricane is first, newborn thunderbolt is second, sudden lightning is third. These three gods as one are Heart of Sky. They came together with Sovereign and Quetzal Serpent. Their joining conceived both light and life. How shall it be sown? They asked. When should dawn come? Who will feed these worlds? Who will sustain them? Let it be like this. Let the water clear away so the plate of earth comes toward the light. Let the land gather and level out. Then it can be sown. Then the dawn can come. But there will be no words of praise or prayer to sing of what we frame and shape until humanity is born, until true people have been made, they said. When it was time to make the earth, it only took a word. To make earth, they said earth. And there it was, sudden as a cloud or mist unfolds from the face of a mountain. So earth was there.
Michael Bazette is the author of You Must Remember This, which received the 2014 Lindquist and Venom Prize for Poetry and The Interrogation. He is also the translator of the Popol Vuh, the first English verse translation of the Mayan creation epic, and the chapbook Imaginary City. His poems have appeared in numerous publications, including Plowshares, The Sun, Massachusetts Review, Pleiades, and Best New Poets. A longtime faculty member at the Blake School, Bazette has received the Bechtel Prize from Teachers and Writers Collaborative and is a 2017 National Endowment for the Arts Fellow. He lives in Minneapolis. Michael, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so a delight.
Perfect. Can you first give us a general overview of the Popol Vuh? What are its origins? What is its story?
Well, it's a Mayan, I call it a creation epic, because in a way, the beginning and ending sections are a creation myth, and embedded inside the creation myth is what's pretty a classic epic, you know, mm-hmm. The only difference is that it's enacted by hero twins instead of, you know, the individual hero that's maybe more common in the sort of the Western conception. But those hero twins need to basically set things right so that the creation of the world can be made complete. It's a nice intermingling. It's kind of like Genesis, Gilgamesh, and the Odyssey kind of rolled into one tidy package. They literally travel to the underworld to overcome the lords of death and then are reborn, which sort of establishes a cycle of regeneration, which is really linked to the agricultural cycle. They become the sun and the moon. We're all set
for ready
the,
to go.
The world to be born.
And the passage you just read was entitled "The Beginning." It was the beginning of the creation myth. Is that right? Can you tell us a little bit about that passage?
Sure. It was actually that moment. One of the things that drew me to the project of translating it, which you know, was kind of immense and took 10 years. but I really, I found that moment fascinating for a number of reasons. Not the least of which is, I don't know if you noticed, but it's. It begins in the present tense. And I love that notion of the creation of the world happening as the story is unfolding, you know, and something that is ongoing. I also love the fact that it comes from a conversation as opposed to, you know, with my upbringing way back in the Catholic cornfields of Rochester, it was all about, you know, that one single voice saying, let there be light, and things sort of happening. And I think that conception of the world arising from conversation instead of a pronouncement really appealed to me. And so in this particular section, it's right at the very beginning. Earth is created using language. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. The myth has a profound sense and understanding of language as this generative tool. But what's interesting is that the test of people, once people, true humans being created, is that they need to be able to speak intelligently back to the gods who created them.
It's a wonderful sort of cyclical phenomenon that happens.
Yeah, I'll create you and you create me. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit. You said it took 10 years for you to translate this. Can you talk a little bit about your entry into this project and where it took you?
Sure. I mean, 10 years kind of from conception and fiddling with it. I think it chose me far more than I chose it. And if I'd known, I think, the arc and the scope of it, I probably would have been a lot more daunted. But it's one of the things about the Popol Vuh that's so wonderful is that it is just on a surface level such a good story. I mean, you could sit down and tell it to an 8-year-old and they'd be enthralled.
Yes,
you know, and that's
yes.
One of the things I love about mythology. It also means there's lots of tasty bite-sized pieces that I could try and sort of cut my teeth on a little bit. And then the myth got its hooks into me and I realized I really wanted to try and get the arc of the mythic section completed. It started when I had a sabbatical in 2007 or 2008 and lived in central Mexico at the time and started to learn a lot about Aztec and Mayan folklore and mythology. And on the side, I was translating a lot of Spanish poetry just to help me learn Spanish. And so the project kind of accidentally came out of the convergence of me becoming fascinated with the process of translation, which is... Translation's kind of like a drug. It's wonderful. You know, you can keep returning to it. And it's a little bit endless. I was translating Neruda because there's like 15 translations of every Neruda poem in English. And then I could put mine side by side with people who knew what they were doing. And that was really fascinating. Yeah. Lo and behold, so it was born.
And how long did the actual process of translation take?
The body of the manuscript itself, I think, about 5 years. Mm-hmm. Of course, I have a day job.
Yes. I imagine that work was just wholly rewarding and enriching. Did you find that so?
Yeah. In fact, I got obsessed enough that I ended up taking an unpaid leave from the Blake School long time ago. I think it was the spring of 2011, mm-hmm. For a semester, simply because once I would get the cadences of the poem in my head that I wanted to write, it would begin to flow. Mm-hmm. But when it would get truncated by a summer break and I'd have to put it away, it was, you know, then I would take a while to pick up the thread, and I just really wanted to create some time so I could just fully inhabit it, because it's, you know, it's a big story.
Yeah, yes, yeah. It is. So speaking of story, I'd like to dive into it just a little bit. Two of the main players in the story are the twins. Let me see if I can get this right now. Hunapu and Xibalanque?
Yeah, Hunapu and Xibalanque.
Xibalanque. And these are twin, they're sort of tricksters.
Yeah.
A little bit. Born of the god Juan Hunapu. What characterizes these boys? Why do you think they're so vital to this story?
That's a great question. And it's... I mean, I think the key word in what you just said, besides trickster and vital, is that they're boys. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting that they seem eternally young, mm-hmm. Even though clearly there's kind of an immense amount of time that passes, especially if you account for that Seven Macaw section early on. It's kind of hard to locate yourself in time. But their playfulness really appeals to me. And the fact, too, that the center of, you know, what we would call the epic or the adventure part, is not founded on a hero, a individual, but a relationship. Mm-hmm. I love that. You know, it's their brothers, but they're friends. One becomes the sun and one becomes the moon. There's a pretty clear hierarchy, but the result of that isn't one feeling sidelined. It's more the outcome of that is stability and balance and equilibrium. They work very well together. There are a few moments where Xibalanque kind of is the moon character, the reflecting character, eclipses, you know, Hunapu in all his glory and the sun character. For instance, when Hunapu's been decapitated and, you know, Xibalanque needs to step up. So it's just that wonderful sort of accidental metaphor provided by the cosmos, where the moon is somehow exactly the same size as the sun from our perspective.
My younger sister would love to hear that. And as Xibalanque replaces Hunapu's head with a squash, which I love. It's fantastic. they're definitely tricksters, and so godlike, though, you know, so incredibly powerful, but they never lose that innocence.
And playfulness, yeah.
And playfulness.
Nor do the older gods, you know. I love the fact that it takes a few drafts to get humanity right. A god who's into revision, I'm down with.
Yes. another character I absolutely loved was Lady Blood in the tale of Lady Blood and the Tree of One Hunapu. She is a maiden of the Lords of Death. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And she ends up conceiving these trickster twins in sort of a virgin birth.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about Lady Blood and why you think she makes such a compelling sort of heroine.
Wow. That's, you know... She's got a little touch of Eve. Mm-hmm. You know, she's with the tree and there's some strange fruit. But she's also, in that case, if you're going to evoke that story, and of course this predates that and wouldn't have overlapped with that story overtly, although Joseph Campbell might have some things to say about that. You know, how far back these stories go, we don't know. But so, yeah, there's an echo of Eve there as kind of, but also the serpent. Mm-hmm. She's both. Mm-hmm. You know, she's the one who says, I will not die. I will not be lost. You know, in Eve, we separate out the temptation into the evil serpent, and we give sort of the purity and elements of desire to the woman. And Lady Blood has both. Mm-hmm. You know, there are times too when she reminds me a little bit of Snow White having to outwit her wicked stepmother, you know.
There's a line I love. So the lords of Chibalba, though that's the lords of death, were defeated because a maiden duped them blind.
Yeah.
I hear your voice in that as well as a little bit of that sort of playfulness again, echoes of that.
I very much, yeah, that was, my job, I felt, the metaphor I kept returning to while I was doing it is I wanted to be a bridge. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, so in the sense there's a lot of structure I was providing, and it, in some ways it's a bold move, but also one thing I love about translation is how it completely it negates the writer and the ego. You're mm-hmm. really there to function as a vessel to someone else's story and words. So you really learn how to listen and read, you know, as much as write.
As the myth concludes, it was so powerful, so emotional and moving. The image of the animals kind of coming down from the mountain, and the sea creatures rise up from the river, and they're here to witness this new dawn, this first sun. What was your relationship to the text as you kind of dived deeper, as the more you got through those 5 years of the process? How do you feel you were changed by this translation?
Well, that's a good question. It's interesting, you know, I did cherry pick a little bit early on, you know, for sections, mm-hmm. but I did that final section that you were just referencing right at the very end. Mm-hmm. I think the section where the first day actually dawns, the sun and the moon come up and all the animals begin to cry out and roar, you know, and there's this chorus. And I'll be honest, I found it deeply moving. It touched me in a way that surprised me a little bit too, because there is that element in being a translator where you're somewhat of a technician. I knew the story. I knew it was coming. You know, there mm-hmm. wasn't necessarily an element of surprise there. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, when I felt it had started to find its form and cadence and rhythm in English, it was kind of like a veil falling away, and I saw that part of the story for the first time, you know, I remember welling up a little bit and thinking, yeah. Oh my God, you know,
I did too.
This has happened. Well, that's wonderful.
So I wanted to return back to this idea of the power of language and naming. You know, as someone who has also grew up in the Catholic neighborhoods, in the Catholic fields, you know, I think of Let There Be Light. I think of this mm-hmm. this declaration of presence, and then suddenly the world is. And I thought the choices of the framer and the shaper, mm-hmm. naming the gods in that way, was really interesting. Could you talk a little bit about the framer and the shaper? And did you choose those words? Was that a translation?
Well, they're pretty straight translations
from the
Quiche, I would say. I mean, a number of people have used those. There's many translations of this that are scholarly. This is the first one that's in verse.
Right.
That was the thing that set it apart. And I was also very much trying to just put foreground that really good story element, so it was lucid, basically, so someone could just lie down in a hammock and read it without the scholarly footnotes and having to be a Mayanist or an anthropologist or anything.
Right.
and I think that the you know, the feeling underneath that was approaching it as a reader, as a poet, but also as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. The language was so vivid, so imagaic. Each translation, you know, I can feel the sort of the ancient wisdom that comes out of it, the sense that these words have existed for a very long time, mm-hmm. from the point of origin, certainly, but, you know, who knows, maybe even before that.
Yeah. Well, and framer and shaper are nice, too, because they imply that there was already something there.
Yeah.
I think that God of Genesis that you're evoking, it's actually ambiguous syntactically if you go back and look, you know. But there's no doubt that the Mayan gods were working with materials that are already there. They were much more artists than the magic trick where it was something from nothing.
Mm.
And that, too, I think resonates with anyone who is using language to try and create a reality. There's a long legacy of that before you, and you need to kind of, you know, take that into account.
Kind of honor it, I think. Yeah. You say in your introduction that the myth unhinges from linear progression, which is something that I've been focused on in my own writing, this idea that the story circles back on itself over and over again, each time rewriting itself just a little bit, each time adding new detail, focusing more on emotions and these tropes. And what was it like to sort of deconstruct that complex narrative to tell it in a way, like you said, you can read it while lying on a hammock, you know, it was easy to understand and yet it was so complex at the same time.
Yeah, it helps not to think about it too much.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there is that kind of, you know, sliding doors or memento element to it, where if you start to look at the linear chronology, and yet at the same time, it reminded me kind of the Arabian Nights, how Scheherazade will be into a story, and then a character inside that story will begin to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
So you get interrupted, and that story's nested, and then one will be nested in that. And so there's this Russian doll construction where you get into kind of the center story and then have to find your way back out. So we begin with the creation of the world and then a few drafts of humanity. And then we get this pretender who's kind of in this dim light of a pre-dawn world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the hero twins come in and deal with him. Then we're like, well, where did they come from?
Mm-hmm.
And then we suddenly are like, well, here are their fathers. What happened to them? And it's like, oh, and here's how the boys were born,
mm-hmm.
you know? And, you know, we go through all of that until we come somehow out the other end of like, oh, now they've become the sun and the moon. And it's like, when did Seven Macaw happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's hard to tell, you know? And of course, once the sun and the moon rays and true humans are created, out of corn. It turns out that was the secret ingredient. I love that.
Just took a little bit of maize and water, that's all.
And then true humans are made. They're able to speak intelligently and mirror back the names of their creators and their gratitude for being created. So they use language in the way that it's meant to be used. And suddenly we're back in that first story again, and it's finally finished. Yeah.
Would you like to read a couple more minutes of a passage?
Sure.
Thank you.
Do you have a preference? We could look at Lady Blood, or we could just...
I would love to look at Lady Blood.
Okay. This, then, is the story of a maiden, the daughter of the Lord named Gathered Blood. I'm going to interrupt for a second, because names like Gathered Blood and Pus Fiend and Flying Scab, you know, they're pretty irresistible. There's something about them, too, that really appeals to, like, the 12-year-old, you know, comic nerd inside.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What's your dad's name? Gathered Blood. This, then, is the story of a maiden, the daughter of the Lord named Gathered Blood. She was the daughter of a lord and thus was known as Lady Blood. When she heard the account of the fruit tree from her father, she was astonished by the tale. Now I'll interrupt here just to highlight that the fruit tree, the fruit that's hanging in the tree, is the skull, the decapitated skull of one Hunapu. Can't I somehow see this tree to better understand its strangeness? I've heard that the fruit is truly delicious, she said. And she left alone to wander beneath the calabash tree at Devastation Ball Court. Ah, what is this fruit? How could it not be delicious, the fruit borne by this tree? I will not die. I will not be lost. Who would even hear if I picked one? Asked the maiden. And then the skull spoke there in the midst of the tree. What could you desire from this? It's just bone, a round thing stuck in the branches, said the head of one Hunapu when it spoke to the maiden. You do not desire it, she was told. But I do desire it, said the maiden. Then open your right hand and reach up into the branches so that I can see it, said the skull. Very well, said the maiden, and she stretched her right hand up to the face of the skull, and it squeezed out a little spit into her open palm. Then she looked into her hand. She wasted no time, but the skull's saliva was gone.
what were those lines that I, but I do desire it, that sort of fierceness. I love.
Yes, that assertion of desire is so wonderful.
So in a few minutes, we'll be wrapping up here, but I wanted to mention in the Adroit Journal, it recently published a reflection on writing a poem, which I love, called The Epidemic. And you say, I don't know why, but this is something I think about a lot. The power of what remains unspoken, what cannot be spoken of silence itself. All of these absences are, I think, necessary elements of poetry, composing the emptiness that allows the little bell of the poem to chime. And my question is, there's a lot said in the Popova. It never hides its intentions. But what do you think the silence between the lines, between the verses, is trying to say? What remains unsaid in the Popova?
What a lovely thought. I mean, one of the most interesting moments for me is at the very end, once the hero twins have defeated the lords of death and are victorious, one of the things they do is go to the same tree that Lady Blood, you know, their mother, I mean, that's the moment of their conception. And they say to the skull of their father, you know, name your eyes, name your nose, name your mouth. They, in a way, want him to speak himself back into being. And he says nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is such a wonderfully resonant silence. They've defeated the lords of death, but there are things that you can't pull back, mm-hmm. you know, from the grave. And I think there is an element, that's one of the reasons I really wanted to, I mean, clearly, when you hear it in the K'iche, there's strong rhythms, it's incantatory, there's cadences at play in it where you hear the oral tradition, you know, that gave it structure.
The 19th annual Bayfront Reggae and World Music Festival takes place July 19th from 3 to 11 p.m. at Bayfront Festival Park in Duluth, Minnesota. Headliners include Jamaican reggae and dancehall artists Romaine Virgo, Charlie Black, and Kenyatta Hill, with culture Nigerian Afrobeats artist Timia. Local favorite Woodblind meets T. Galexi and DJ Sound of Fusion from Trinidad. Tickets and more info available online at bayfrontworldmusic.com.
Been listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric, and we would like to thank Leif Weatherby and all of our listeners. Without your support, KFAI would not be possible. Now stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.